Hello and welcome to the Weatherby Q2 podcast. We are excited to be talking to you today, and boy, do we have a great guest to speak with today about a number of topics, one that is certainly on our mind. But first of all, let me tell you about an informational leadership management type webinar series that we are going to present in May. And I'm actually going to have the opportunity to do this, so I'm so excited. We're going to do it every Wednesday in May, so that'll be four Wednesdays. And then we got to bleed into June just a little bit, and we'll do, finish up on that first Wednesday in June. But from a topic perspective, I've tried to really listen to what you guys have said whenever I've been out and about in different states and areas. And quite honestly, it's what people in all industries are saying, but we're going to certainly tailor it to the hospice industry. So our first session will be Understanding Millennials and Gen Z and How That Relates to the Workforce. In our second session, we'll be talking about attracting the right millennials and Gen Zers to work in hospice. In our third session, it will be about creating a culture for millennials and Gen Zers to thrive in, not just to be in, but we want them to thrive in it. Our fourth session will be getting the most out of millennials and Gen Zers. And then we will wrap up with a little thing I call Hiring for Grit. And it is based off of a book that I read a few years ago by Angela Duckworth. Her book is called Grit, The Power of Passion and Perseverance. But I really tailor it to kind of the HR world and how do you hire with grit so you can have retention, longevity, and create loyalty. So those are our topics for our webinar series, like I said, that starts in May. All you guys will be receiving more information on this soon and how you can register. And so we hope that you will join us for that. And like I said, we have just got a really smart, outstanding person to talk to today. He and I had a conversation earlier this week in preparing for this podcast, and I could have probably talked to him all afternoon because it's just very informational and numbers-driven, and I'm really data and numbers-driven. But we have Jay Cushman with us today, and Jay is the founder and the president of a company called Health Pivots. He is a consultant in the healthcare field, and guys, he has been doing this for a little bit. He's been doing it for 40 years and just has a deep, deep expertise in the post-acute sector. Since 1985, Jay has provided management, consulting, and health planning services, as well as expert testimony on the planning and regulation of health services. He was one of the first to do some of this stuff. He was an early adopter of planning and analytics, developing custom software to really exploit extensive health databases. And whenever you hear him today, you're going to know it. He is passionate about enabling healthcare organizations to make data-driven decisions by making complex data accessible, but not only accessible, he makes it understandable. He could definitely talk on my level the other day, so if he can do that and I can understand it, anybody can. But he founded Health Pivots in order to put interactive and actionable data tools in the hands of decision makers within the healthcare sector. And guys, he has got a wonderful resume, CV of all the things that he has done. And I'm sure you can look on their website, healthpivots.com, and see that. But I want to dive into our conversation with Jay. And we certainly would be remiss if we did not start off our conversation by discussing all that's going on in our world. Because when you guys get this and you hear it, it will still be going on pretty strongly. But with COVID-19, Jay, I'm just going to give it wide open to you. What are your thoughts about how this is impacting not only hospice, but our world and in your world? Just give us some information on that.
Melanie, we are literally living through history right now. And none of us who come through this experience will ever forget what we've been doing in our family life and our professional life. And it's certainly, just since you and I talked the other day, so much has changed and continues to change. And it's difficult for me to avoid being distracted by all the news that's out there, a lot of which just seems to be just noise and distracting from kind of the purposes that I think we all should be engaged in, which is support our families, support our colleagues, and see that the people who depend on us can continue to rely on us. And part of that is keeping ourselves safe so that we can continue to help others. But just today, just as before our call, we see a notice coming out from NHPCO about the effect of this new coronavirus relief bill that the Senate has passed. It's not yet law, but it will have an effect on hospices. There'll be lots of funding available to support all the demands being placed on the healthcare sector. And in addition, there'll be some relaxation of some of the rules and financial constraints that apply to hospice. These are very short-term efforts, and certainly as the time goes by and it clarifies what the situation will be, that longer-term changes may be required to maintain the level of service that we've been accustomed to as hospice providers to provide.
Exactly. And you know, I know even before the Senate passed it, and I know it's going to the House and all of that, but even I think last week, and you certainly correct me if I'm wrong, but there were some stipulations made for reimbursement regarding telemedicine and all of that. Can you speak to that?
Yes. So particularly as it applies to hospice will be able to do face-to-face recertification now by telehealth. Physicians and nurse practitioners who formerly would have to come face-to-face to recertify a patient will be able to do it remotely. And there may be some additional relief in a financial way provided by reimbursing for telehealth visits.
Great. And speak to, because you and I talked about this the other day, just the effect that it's having given the kind of large percentage, and in some areas it's larger than others, but the percentage of hospice patients in a long-term care facility or in facilities, and how that is impacting.
Yes, so it's quite interesting that though the majority of patients who come to hospice come directly from a hospital, either as an inpatient or an outpatient. And quite often, those patients make up have shorter stays than we'd like because they're quite sick when they come out of the hospital.
Right.
Patients who come to hospice while they're in a nursing facility or assisted living facility are likely to have longer stays. So whereas they don't make up a larger share of admissions to hospice, they make up a disproportionate share of hospice census. And of course, hospice census is what we're reimbursed for by Medicare. And one of the challenges that I've heard in the news concerning hospice patients who live in nursing facilities or in assisted living facilities is questions that the operators of those facilities have about the safety of allowing outsiders, including hospice professionals, to come into their facility to give needed care, and also concerns about the safety for the hospice professionals who are entering these facilities. And of course, we're dealing with a changing situation, but everyone now understands the importance of social distancing and the importance of proper personal protective equipment. Yeah. To protect yourself and others. And I think that there are temporary dislocations happening at this point, changes in the flow of patients. I believe, based on my contacts with a number of my colleagues who are hospice providers, that hospice admissions have not, for the moment, declined. Perhaps as a consequence of hospitals having to create bed capacity and perhaps discharge more patients directly to the home setting than they would, and calling on hospice professionals to care for them. And so admissions seem to be holding up. But I am concerned that the referral pipeline coming out of facilities, particularly nursing homes and assisted living facilities, may begin to dwindle. And that will have a quite an impact on not only the care for people who are residents of those facilities, but on the hospices who rely on those patient days for reimbursement.
That's right. Exactly. And speaking to something you said a moment ago, I think you and I discussed this the other day, that a friend of mine who is a physician, and he is the medical director for several facilities in the panhandle of Florida, actually, and he and I were talking the other day, and all the facilities are not allowing him in or his nurse practitioners, but they're doing telemedicine, but they're not getting even to go into the facilities now, as, like I said, him as the medical director. So very impactful. Let's wrap up this little piece about what we're going through now, and tell me just a couple of things. What do you see, and you said a couple of things a moment ago related to facilities, but what do you see as kind of the long-term impact of this, and how does all of this change our relationships with post-acute care?
So I think we're still all wondering about the short-term impact, of course.
Yes.
And we're dealing with that now from day to day. And hopefully we'll be able to overcome some of these dislocations that are keeping needed care from people. In the longer term, I think these connections, these important connections between physicians and post-acute providers and hospitals and facilities and post-acute providers, is that will there be a change in this relationship to acknowledge the importance of community-based, home-based care, and in addition of palliative care. And that is the ability, particularly of hospice professionals, to manage a chronically ill population at home or in non-acute settings to provide quality of life and comfort care, even in the presence of a serious illness, though it may not be a terminal illness. So I am looking on the bright side.
Right.
I am hoping that that a long-term effect of this is a heightened regard and respect for hospice and palliative care, and the ability of those professionals to address the healthcare concerns in an effective and efficient way going forward.
Good. That's very hopeful. I love that. I love to end a conversation on a good note, and that is a great place to jump off into what we're going to talk about next, which is clearly what you guys do at Health Pivots, and how you it's fascinating to me, because like I told you I'm numbers driven. I'm that person who only likes to drink out of a certain size bottle of water because I can measure that. I know it's 33 ounces. I know that sounds crazy as it relates, but I'm just numbers driven. And so in all of my hospice business, which is a numbers driven business, I've always been fascinated. So I look forward to the next part of our conversation. So let's start at the base with the basics, because that's kind of what I need to start with personally. But just tell our audience, what are analytics?
So analytics is our business, and our business is to take data, often very large amounts of data and disaggregated data, and to distill it in a meaningful way to provide support to decision makers to make decisions that improve quality of care and effectiveness of care and efficiency of care. And by the way, I think we can transition between this discussion of COVID-19 pandemic and the general application of analytics, just to recognize what a huge role analytics are playing today in in responding to this emergency situation. It was weeks ago that we began preparing for what is expected to be in the near future a surge in very acute cases affecting our hospitals. And it's the analytics discipline of epidemiology that has led to this preparation. And so the same sort of skills in distilling large amounts of data and modeling data and the consequences of choices. We've all heard about flattening the curve, which means taking a very sharp and unacceptably large impact to our healthcare system and moderating the impact through social distancing, and even in some cases, like in my state, a total lockdown. And so the same thing we're able to do within our field of analytics, which is health services research. We look at histories of individual patients, primarily through Medicare claims data, to follow them over time and to see the consequences of decisions made along their healthcare trajectories, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, concerning flattening the curve, we've observed, and many people have, that as at the end of life, as a person approaches the end of life, their demands for healthcare services expands. And in fact, in the last weeks of life, it expands exponentially, unless hospice care is brought in at an appropriate time, in which case you can see that instead of having this surge in healthcare expenditures in the last 4, 5, 6 weeks of life, you have a moderating effect where hospice care comes in and substitutes for unnecessary and ineffective acute care at a time when comfort care is what's really needed. So there is a flattening of the curve, if you will, that we see in our studies of healthcare data. And again, as I said, primarily Medicare data.
Okay. So tell me a little bit more about the data available. What kind of data is it, and you know, how it matters in our world?
So Medicare keeps very detailed records on patients who receive Medicare benefits, both for original Medicare enrollees, that is those who are engaged in fee-for-service Medicare, like the hospice field, for example, is all handled under the fee-for-service system. And also, Medicare keeps detailed records of encounters for their enrollees who are part of Medicare Advantage plans, which are commercial plans that support the Medicare benefit. And so there's a very large, if you can imagine, set of data that includes data on hospice utilization, on hospital and skilled care, and on home health care, and durable medical equipment, and physicians as well. And for us, as researchers and analysts, the real magic of this data is that we can follow an individual person over long periods of time to see the choices that are made in their care as they approach some pivot event. And I must say that the name of our company, Health Pivots, is based around this idea that along the pathway to care, there's pivotal events where choices have to be made. And for example, a pivotal event could be a hospital stay, and that choice has to be made at the end of the hospital stay. What's the appropriate place for this patient to go after leaving the hospital? Mm-hmm. Should this patient just go home and look after themselves? Or should they go home with some sort of home support, like home health care, or if at the end of life, hospice care? And based upon those choices, you can see consequences. And I think it stands out particularly when you look at the hospital setting. A patient in the hospital with a limited time to live, the choices of whether or not to send that patient to hospice or to some other setting makes a world of difference, particularly in the likelihood that that patient will be rehospitalized before they die.
Okay. So I'm thinking about some of the information that you sent me, and one of the things as a having trained people to sell hospice for years and years, one of the things that sticks out to me that I would just love to dive into is the demographic, the utilization trends. And so I just think stuff like that is so interesting and so helpful for providers.
So speaking of trends, there's two kinds of analytics that we emphasize in our work, just to be able to understand and model the healthcare decision-making process. One is trend data, for what will follow a particular statistic over time. For example, in a different particular county, what percentage of the deaths in that mm-hmm. county are under hospice care?
Right.
We can follow that statistic over time to try to characterize that county in terms of its progress in providing hospice care.
Right.
Another kind of analytics we use is, rather than looking over many years of time to look at trends, is to choose one particular year and ask, for example, thinking of that same county, well, that county has achieved a certain level of hospice use, and how do we judge that compared to other counties? Is it high or low? So in that case, we do benchmarking, in which case we rank that county, for example, within its state to see, well, is it at the higher end, the lower end, or is it in the middle? So those two kinds of analytics, trending to see overall changes in factors that influence the use of healthcare, and benchmarking or ranking to see at a particular point in time, where is a particular provider or a particular county or zip code, how well is the service being provided at that time compared to other similar areas.
Okay. So, Jay, in addition to Medicare, is there any other specific source that you gather data from?
Well, Medicare is our primary source. So when I think about it, it all somehow or other comes through government sources, because they're actually required to share some data in the public interest. So that includes data like Medicare claims for the fee-for-service population, or data from the Medicare Advantage encounter data set, or Medicare cost reports. Again, information required by Medicare for providers who participate in the Medicare system.
Right.
And also information generated by the quality reporting programs at Medicare, including the Hospice Compare and the Home
right.
Health Compare and SNF Compare, and also the results of value-based purchasing, which impact hospitals in particular.
Okay, that's very interesting. So talking about Medicare, tell me a little about the impacts of Medicare policy, some of the things that's passed down from there. You know, for instance, as it relates to face-to-face.
Well, the Medicare plays an outsized role in determining how even services are defined and what is permissible practice. All hospice providers are familiar with the Medicare conditions of participation, which requires them to provide standard and minimum levels of care in order to qualify. And so the rules that Medicare sets have a huge impact on the way that care is provided. And so some recent examples of how Medicare has impacted health delivery is in the field of home health and skilled nursing, where they've completely turned over the method that home health and skilled nursing are under which they're paid. And about 15 years ago, when they changed from reimbursing home health on a visit basis to an episode basis, about half of the home health agencies ceased business within about 2 years. And gradually that sector has rebuilt. Now, what I've seen in hospice is that the hospice reimbursement method has been fairly stable mm-hmm. for many, many years, and it's helped support a steady growth of the hospice sector. But there have been some hints recently in the last several years of change. And one example is when in 2011, Medicare began requiring face-to-face recertifications. and also about the same time when they started excluding certain diagnoses.
Right.
End-of-life diagnoses. And although hospices were able to respond and accommodate those changes, it did have a chilling effect on some of the referral sources who, when these changes came about, thought to themselves, oh, perhaps I haven't been following the rules. And I don't think that we've totally recovered from the impact of those changes to totally rebuild the connections we used to have with our referral sources.
Right.
More recently, Medicare has introduced this two-tier reimbursement system for paying for routine home care.
Mm-hmm.
MedPAC has recommended that Medicare Advantage plans be permitted to negotiate for hospice services in the future for their beneficiaries rather than requiring them to send their patients to hospices to get their hospice care through fee-for-service. And also, very recently, MedPAC recommended reducing the per-beneficiary cap limit. So mm-hmm. all of these changes in policy which emanate from Medicare can have very large consequences for the way care is delivered or even defined.
Right.
And as I said earlier, one of my hopes is that Medicare will, in a more formal way, recognize the value of palliative care that's delivered for chronically ill people,
yes.
regardless of their terminal status.
Yes.
And so again, hoping for the best, hoping that the crisis we're going through will open people's eyes about that and broaden the ability of Medicare to pay for those needed services.
Right. I was going to ask you, Jay, I think everybody probably listening to this call is in our business, is in the hospice industry. So everybody knows that palliative care is the umbrella and hospice is a type of palliative care. But a true palliative care program, like you mentioned, for chronic illness and disease, most are nurse practitioner driven. But those types of programs, are you seeing an uptick across the country in those types of programs?
Yes, dramatic increase. And of course, and hospices are leading the way
right.
in providing the care. However, there are very seldom break-even programs.
Yes, right.
Because the real value of the service is not properly recognized.
That's right, exactly.
It is possible, again, through data, through analytics, to look at patients who receive a palliative care consult in the acute care setting, and then to observe the impact it has on their likelihood to be readmitted to the hospital. And it's easy to see
right.
that palliative care consult does result in a significant reduction in readmissions.
Right, exactly. Exactly. Well, listen, I could ask you questions all day long and get such valuable information, but we appreciate your time so much. And I think it's a busy time for people like you. Some people's lives have slowed down a little bit, but I think that you're probably in front of a computer and looking at data all the time. But we appreciate it so much, and we will have your information and your contact information, the healthpivots.com information, on distributed with this call and on our site. So if people listening to this would like to contact you for a consult or for further information, they can certainly do that. But Jay, we appreciate your time so much.
Thank you, Melanie. It's a pleasure to talk to you, and stay safe.
Yes, you too. And guys, Q3, so this is our Q2 podcast, and so I just want to go ahead and promote Q3 just a little bit. We'll be out this summer. And Rachel Hold Weiss, and Rachel is an attorney with Aaron Fox, and we're going to talk about contracts and contractual agreements and how all those play out for in the hospice environment. And then again, don't forget about our May webinar series, where we will try to drill down and do some generational teaching specific to how you can hire these people, how you can retain them, build loyalty and longevity in your organization. And so we are looking forward to that. Thank you so much for attending and listening to the Weatherby Q2 podcast.